Welcome to Conversations. I'm your host, Greg Thomas S. Thanks for spending some time with us this weekend. Joining me this segment is Kellen Prowse, a young man afflicted by multiple sclerosis. Just to have a positive attitude and uses words to help others feeling their way through a tough diagnosis, MS. It's an uncertain path, life-changing turn of events. Good morning, Kellen.
Good morning.
Join us as we look at the issues that affect us here at home in our community and across the nation. The Pacific Northwest sees some of the highest occurrences of multiple sclerosis in the nation. Kellen is a proud author of Wheels and Red. It's a website documenting the challenge of living with MS with the positive outlook of how much fun you can still have living life. March is National MS Awareness Month, and Kellen seeks to do his part to help those struggling see there's the possibility for a pretty great life. He's a husband, a father in Western Washington, on disability, and able to make it all work. And it's quite impressive. Kellen, what do you do? What's your thing? What are you into?
What's my thing? Right now, it's just living life to the fullest, man. It's just getting out and spending as much time with my family, adventuring around the Pacific Northwest, and sharing it on Wheels and Red.
When were you diagnosed with MS?
I was diagnosed in 2010 at the age of 25, which is kind of a lot of people think that's a pretty young age to be diagnosed, but it's actually really common to be diagnosed kind of the ages like 20 to 40. So there's actually quite a few people diagnosed that young.
It's got to be a tough pill to swallow when you first find out. How did you first, what were the first symptoms that you had? How did your diagnosis go?
For me, I had been seeing a pain doctor for my back for a long time, for about, I don't know, a year. I guess it wasn't that long. But my legs had gone numb, and they kind of passed it off as, well, you probably got a pinched nerve in your back. Your back isn't the best, so things probably aren't that great. And then I got an MRI of my lower back, and by chance, they caught a little bit of my mid-spine, the thoracic spine, and they found some lesions, which is typical of MS. Which is the scarring that MS leaves on the spine.
Kellen, sorry to interrupt, but I guess I don't really understand exactly what MS is. Can you give us an example to help better understand it?
Yeah, sure. So MS is a chronic illness that affects the central nervous system, predominantly the spinal cord and the brain. And MS blocks the nerve signal and leaves scars. And it's similar to if you have headphones that get frayed and all of a sudden they start cutting out. It's the exact same thing with your central nervous system.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
So they find some lesions where this is starting to happen to your nervous system. And then how does that follow? They're like, oh, that looks like it could be a problem. Do you go through a series of MRIs then to try and pinpoint it?
Yeah, so then after they found the few lesions, I went through and then got a series of four more MRIs kind of from the lower back all the way up to the brain. And they look through and see, you know, if you have any more lesions. And then the other thing they do is they do a lumbar puncture.
Oh.
Which sounds, it's not nearly as fun as it sounds.
I'm going to be honest with you, it doesn't sound fun.
Right. So they go in and
are we used to hearing that called a spinal tap?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep, spinal tap. Same thing. And they draw cerebral spinal fluid from your spinal cord, and they test it for a protein. To see if there's this protein, I think it's a protein called O-bands. And it's one of those things where if you have O-bands, or you don't necessarily, let's see, how I get confused on this one. But if you...
Just because you have OBANs doesn't mean that you have MS, right?
Correct. Thank you. Yes.
Okay. So you did?
Yes. Yeah, I had OBANs. And then, a lot of people, when they find their lesions, they have maybe a couple spots on their spine. They're usually roundish, kind of like coin-looking things on the MRI. And for me, you have three parts of your spine, the lumbar, the thoracic, and cervical. The lumbar is the bottom. The cervical is the neck part. So my cervical spine was kind of one big lesion. So they had no question. They were like, yep, that's MS.
Oh, man. And there's not just one type of MS, right? Aren't there multiple types?
Yeah. So it's like, so there's four different, like, flavors, if you will. And 85% of people who are newly diagnosed with MS are diagnosed with a type called relapsing remitting. So you have a relapse and your MS flares up. That's kind of, call them flare ups.
Yeah.
And then it's different for every person and every flare up, but they can last weeks, months. For me, my latest flare-up I've been kind of battling since November of last year.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And then there's relapsing remitting. Then there's primary progressive, where there is no relapse in remission. It just, you slowly deteriorate with any, you don't have any remission in between them. And that one's like one of the most severe cases. And then where I'm transitioning into is secondary progressive MS. And that is when someone with relapsing remitting transitions into it's like starting with relapsing remitting and then you transition into primary progressive.
Oh,
but they call it secondary progressive because it comes after. And most people, it kind of starts at the 10-year mark. About is when people transition into that. I'm at the 5-year mark, so I'm a tad ahead of schedule.
You're a real go-getter, Kelly.
Yeah, I'm out there.
Now, so you're faced with this really daunting diagnosis. How do you turn that into something positive? How do you stay so bright about it?
I haven't always been bright about it. The first couple of years were really rough in trying to figure out what it meant and how it changed my life and the things that were important to me. But going through that transition has shown me, it really shows you that tomorrow isn't guaranteed for anyone, and I've decided to live in a way where the days that I can get up and get out, I want to spend my time doing things that make me happy and spending time around people that make me happy, instead of, sitting at home and kind of wallowing in this thing that, is kind of slowly chipping away at all the things that I used to be able to do. So, it's easier to focus on the happier side of what I can do.
And that's sort of the purpose of Wheels and Red. That's your blog that you write, wheelsandred.com. I've looked at it a little bit, and it seems like there you're having fun and showing what you can still do rather than worrying about what you can't.
Yeah, absolutely.
Has it been helpful to people? Have you been able to communicate the optimism that you can still have?
Yeah, the response has actually been amazing. I launched it at the end of January, and people have really, really, really enjoyed what I've been putting out there. Because I've been reaching out not only to the MS community, but the the disabled community, and I'm not just sharing how to live a positive life and try and get out there and experience life with MS, but I'm also trying to break down the stigma of what disability looks like, and show that there's disabilities out there that you can't see, and young dudes with tattoos and piercings and plugs have disabilities too, which is usually, people are usually like, oh, I wouldn't have guessed you were disabled.
As the disease continues, you start to lose feeling in your limbs, I understand, so you start to not be able to do the things you used to. Like, what's some of the things that you miss from when you, before you had MS?
It's weird because it's like, it's the little things. So right now, it's, I miss, like, being able to button my shirt. Because my hands are so numb that I have a hard time feeling the different textures. So it's amazing how much slight texture changes on the tip of your finger make things so much easier. Let's see. So buttoning my shirt is...
How about just going to work and things like
yeah.
that?
Yeah, absolutely. I used to think that to have like this successful life, I had to get up and work a 9-to-5 job and provide for my family. And MS has really shaken my role in the family. And not that it's worse, but it's just different.
To find out more about Kellen Prowse, please visit his website, wheelsandred.com. And to get involved with Walk MS Seattle or any of the other walks in the area to help out and raise awareness and raise funding for MS research, visit walkms.org. Kellen, thanks so much for calling in, man.
Yeah, thanks.
And thank you for joining us today. Conversations is the public affairs program of this station.
Good morning and welcome to Conversations. I'm your host, Tony Russell, and this is going to be an interesting show this morning. I guess you could call it Cannabis 101. We have Chris Boucher visiting with us today. He is the Vice President of Product Development at a place called Cannavest, cannavest.com. And Chris says there is a big misunderstanding about marijuana, about hemp, about cannabis. What is this whole thing about THC and the levels found in certain things? And what about medical marijuana versus recreational marijuana? And why should we, as a country, want to see mass production of hemp? Well, Chris says he can give us the answers to all of those questions. And I don't know about you, I look forward to learning more about this very interesting substance that seems to be on everyone's mind, not only in Washington, Colorado, Alaska, and Washington, D.C., but other places around the country. Good morning, Chris. How are you?
I'm doing great, Tony. Thanks for having me here.
And this is pretty good timing to have you on the show, of course, because the great state of Washington somewhat recently legalized marijuana, and it is up and running at full force right now. I don't know a lot about the industry per se, but from what I understand, they are at first they couldn't keep it on the shelves, and they had a shortage. But now I hear we have a surplus. You might know the answer to that. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I heard, you know, just in the news that, you know, supply and demand, and, you
right.
know, the suppliers just overcompensated for the demand. And
right.
I'm sure it's going to turn around again now that summer's coming, and a lot of the outdoor cannabis is now drying up. But it sounds like, you know, it goes back and forth, and it will always be that way, hopefully.
And so let's kind of jump right into somewhat of a little bit of a controversial maybe topic. What is the difference between medical marijuana and recreational marijuana?
You know, I always tell people that medical marijuana, if it's medical, it probably should be grown in a clean, safe environment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't want birds nesting in your plant or flying over, pooping on it. You don't want, you know, a big pine tree blowing its pollen all over it, because when people are sick and it has contaminants on it, mm-hmm. their immune system's already down as it is. So, you know, you don't get your oxycodone or your Xanax from an outdoor, you know, pharmacy. It's made in the clean tech environment. And I'm not trying to compare the two, but, you know,
right.
where recreational, I think, you know, maybe might be more inclined to outdoor, of course, and indoor too, both of them. But I think there's definitely a big difference and much more regulation on testing and cannabinoid terpene count and all that good stuff.
Now, you own the company, as I said earlier, Cannavest, and that's spelled CannaVest. That's Cannavest.com. For you guys, it's not just about marijuana.
Well, we're a multifaceted corporation. Cannavest is a publicly traded company. And what we do is we invest into the infrastructure of agricultural hemp. We grow about maybe 4,000 acres of agricultural hemp in Europe. We also grow agricultural hemp in Kentucky, here in the United States. And so we grow this agricultural hemp that's below 1% THC. It's all 0.3% THC, which is non-psychoactive.
Mm-hmm.
And we extract the CBD, the cannabidiol, from the agricultural hemp. And then we process it. We lab test it. You know, third-party verification. We test for heavy metals. We want to make sure it's safe for everyone to use.
And how do they use hemp versus marijuana?
You know, the same way. They actually, a lot of it's edibles. A lot of people take it in the oil format, sublingual, behind the tongue. There's also transdermal patches people can use. You know, a lot of people think of marijuana, they just think of a big joint, you know, and smoking
right.
it. Well,
Cheech and Chong.
You know, yeah, we need to erase that image. You know, people, you know, use it in a multitude of ways. So there's different ways to consume it. Like I said, either, you know, a spray, a tincture, a lozenger, a cream. You can rub it on your skin if you're in pain.
Right.
Or you can smoke it. So the delivery methods are quite different, and it's expanding as I speak.
Okay, and let me interrupt just one second to make sure the listener's clear. We're talking at this moment about the hemp plant, and you're saying you can use it like people use marijuana. And what do most people want to use it for? Because you're saying it doesn't have that. It's not going to, as we say, the crude language, I guess. It's not going to give you a buzz. It's not going to get you high. What can it, how does it help people, in your opinion, the hemp?
Yes, it gives people the benefit of using cannabis without getting high, especially little kids. You know, I don't know if you saw that special on CNN with Dr. Sanjay Gupta, and the little baby had, she was like 3 years old. She had over 100 seizures a day.
Yes, I did see
that. And they gave her some, you know, agricultural hemp CBD, was non-psychoactive. And she went from, you know, 100 seizures a day down to one a week. So, and there's a lot of old people that need the benefit of CBD, cannabidiol. If you look up on the internet the uses of it, you know, it's a neuroprotectant, you know, people with Alzheimer's or brain injury.
Mm-hmm.
A matter of fact, it's so vital that the United States government owns the patent on it, patent 507.
That tells you something, that they would buy the patent on it, right?
What are you planning on doing with it?
Mm-hmm. Now, and that kind of brings up an interesting point. I watched the documentary, I think it's called Culture High. The Culture High or Cultural High? Have you seen that?
Yeah, no, I haven't seen that one, but I have heard about it.
Absolutely amazing documentary. And they kind of touch on something that you do if people go to your website at cannavest.com. Cannabis and hemp were seen at one time as a vital part of our agriculture, a part of our country. I guess at one point it was even illegal to not grow it in times of shortage. What were they using it for early on in the 1900s?
Well, you know, if we go back to Christopher Columbus, I mean, if it wasn't for cannabis hemp, we wouldn't have discovered America. How could you get a ship across the ocean with a cotton sail? The salt water would rot it and would rip within a week.
Mm.
So the main fuel of world commerce, world discovery, was all because of hemp canvas. The word canvas actually means cannabis, okay? So every ship that crossed the ocean for 300 years was powered by a hemp sail. okay? The boat was lined with hemp oakum so it wouldn't sink.
Wow.
Okay?
So people they have to get it out of their mind when they hear hemp or cannabis that it's automatically a drug people use to get stoned. This is something that you're saying can be used in many different ways.
It was the fuel of the economy.
Wow.
It was the most important asset into world commerce. You know, we couldn't get our goods to other countries or ship them down the coast if we didn't have hemp sales powering these boats. So when you first came to Jamestown Colony in the 1600s, it was mandatory that you grew hemp. The Plymouth colonies, you mandatory that you grew hemp because it was the fuel that I believe that just pushed the commerce and survival forward, because the clothing, the fuel, the sails, the ropes, we needed that. And then the medicine. I mean, this is the number one prescribed medicine for over 150 years in America.
What was the big thing that they realized it helped with back early on? Was it just inflammation, or just they probably didn't even realize what impact it had?
Dysentery. I mean, they used it for certain coughs. I believe migraines. You know, I know Queen Elizabeth was the third. She was quite a frequent user of cannabis.
Mm-hmm.
They used it for illness. Mary Todd Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln's wife, was a known cannabis user because she had actual, you know, some issues she needed to use it for. But it was used quite a bit, you know, considering, you know, at the time where medicine was at. It was always known from, you know, the time of, you know, antiquities until, you know, 5,000 years later. We know this is historically true. You can't lie about history, but what you can do, what our government did, is they took this information, they removed it from our textbooks, they removed it from our history books.
Mm-hmm.
So when we went to school, we didn't learn any of this. They didn't want us to know. Why? I don't know. But, you know, we need to really put this back into the history books, you know, teach our children the truth about America, how it was founded, and why hemp was so important. I mean, I always say hemp is more American than apple pie. We used to salute to a hemp flag. Betsy Ross's flag was made from hemp.
Mm.
What do we do now? We salute to a nylon DuPont made in China flag.
Right.
Something's gone wrong.
Something has changed. Now, because we don't have that much time, unfortunately, because this is just a fascinating topic to me. But now, your company, Cannavest, you also have some nutritional and personal care products as well. How are you guys using this, and for what type of ailments?
Yeah, cannabis, we do a whole line called Plus CBD Oil,
mm-hmm.
and it's all from hemp oil. It's a hemp plant that we extract the CBD from, and we do them like a little sprays you spray in your mouth. We have capsules that are 25 milligrams. You eat the capsule. We have salves and body lotion. We have a whole line called Cibaderm that, you know, shampoos, soap, all infused with CBD. And it's great for the skin. It's great for the internal dietary supplement. You know, it's hard for me to make any claims because it's a dietary supplement.
Sure, absolutely.
And the FDA just sent out 9 letters to companies selling CBD products that were making medical claims.
Right. What would you like to see in the future? I mean, what is your goal and the goal of Cannavest when it comes to marijuana and hemp in this country? What would you like to see done with it?
I'd like to see it, you know, just like vitamin C or, you know, just like a supplement. You go to any store, you'll be able to buy it. You know, and you'll have all different kinds. You'll have stuff that's psychoactive, non-psychoactive. I mean, there's over 100 different, you know, cannabinoids that are in cannabis, and they're not all psychoactive. You know, you go to your pharmacist, you can go to your local dispensary. I see factories and mills in some of these farming communities that are going to make, you know, textiles for clothing.
Mm-hmm.
Protein powder for athletes, you know, professional football players, you know, CBD for people with Alzheimer's and brain injury.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, THC for people that have cancer. I mean, on and on. There's so many different aspects of this, and I'm not a doctor. I'm not making any claims.
As Chris said, you know, he's not a doctor. I'm not a doctor. Do your own research. Talk to your own medical professionals before, you know, taking any supplements or even experimenting with cannabis. That's that is all up to you. We're not here today to try to sway anyone to one direction or the other. And if someone would like to come on with an opposite view that they heard today, we would welcome that as well.
Conversations is a public affairs program of this station.
Welcome to Conversations. I'm your host, Greg Thomas S. Thanks for spending some time with us this morning. Joining me this segment is John Horvat, a socioeconomist and author of the book Return to Order. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Great to be on the show.
Join us as we look at the issues that affect us here at home in our community and across the nation. I'm regularly pretty surprised by how much better my nephews and niece are at operating computer technology than their mother or father, my sibling. They were born at an age of the digital tablet, and they use it like I used to use a bicycle to like fill idle time. Well, we live in Seattle, a culture that's buzzing thanks to a boom from technology giants setting up house in our own neighborhood. Mr. Horvat explores the connection between our growing push to have everything and everyone connected in the digital world, and he provides an interesting example of one man known for shaping our digital daily habits. He gave us the iPhone and later the iPad, a tool that I can't seem to pry out of my young nieces and nephews' hands. They get really set upon doing these things, and they get really good at it, too. This man made it able for us all to have this type of technology in our laps without having a laptop, able to interact with touch, something really easy to communicate with. All of this in contradiction to his approach at his own home. Now, John, the man I'm speaking about is Steve Jobs, longtime Apple mastermind. Can you please explain what I hinted at with Jobs and his approach to digital technology at home?
Right. Steve Jobs, he gave us all those gadgets, but when it came to his own children, he kept them away from it. They didn't have iPads or iPhones, and they went to a normal dinner and talked about history and books.
Well, why the contradiction, do you think, between what Jobs markets and what he practices with his children?
Well, I think Jobs lived a contradiction. He knew he had to live in the real world if he wanted to get things done, but he wanted to create this dream world of gadgets where you can have everything instantly. It's part of our, what I call our culture of unrestraint.
What's that?
It's this idea you have to have everything now instantly. You know, there should be no limits. We sort of do that when we live beyond our own means. You know, we should live in the real world, but a lot of times we just give in to the temptation and splurge and spend and spend and spend.
Is that kind of related to our own economy right now in the United States?
Exactly. I mean, that's the point I make in the book, Return to Order, that you know, that we live in a frenzied economy. It's something I call frenetic intemperance. You know, this idea of instant gratification, of just throwing aside certain aspects of reality, and this is destroying our culture and economy. It's throwing everything out of balance, and I think that Jobs, you know, he pretty much understood that, at least the part about balance in the home.
That's interesting, because we create all this stuff to make things happen faster, but we don't necessarily need to. What drives us to do that?
It is part of this culture of unrestraint, this idea that there should be no restraints, and that, you know, we need to just get rid of anything that may slow us down, and this really goes against our very nature. We need that resting time. We need to, you know, slow down at times, and it's especially true in families.
Are there other high-tech parents limiting their children's intake of gadgetry, do you think?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm sure there are. In fact, when I was doing research for the Steve Jobs article, you know, they mentioned the fact that there's a elementary school in Silicon Valley, right where Jobs lived, that all the high-tech parents sent their children. It was low-tech. They didn't have tablets. They just did times tables and, you know, the normal things children do at school.
Oh, that's interesting. It seems sort of strange, then, that people would create something that they know is kind of hindering the culture. I can't understand what the connection would be there.
I think they're just going with the flow of things. You know, the flow of things goes. They're taught that at the universities. They're taught, you know, the one thing. But when it comes down to doing it, they say, wait a minute. You know, I can't, if I'm going to make money, I'm going to really do something great, I can't be on my iPad all the time. I've got to do some work.
What's going to be the
reality comes in. You
know? What's going to be the thing that brings us back down to earth?
Well, I think there's a lot of backlash of people who recognize the problem of technology overload. I mean, just ask any parent; they'll tell you that. And there are parents who are moving in that direction of, you know, of low-tech schools or holidays or weekends. There are people who want more organic things, you know, the more human side of production and products. And you see that in, you know, wines and cheeses and microbreweries. You know, these are things that go outside the box, the technological box, and give more meaning to life. And that's really what I think a return to order is all about, reconnecting with those things and disconnecting from these tech overload problems that we have.
It's interesting you say that. Here in Seattle, I've seen advertisements recently for an adult summer camp offering a digital detox, like to get away for a weekend from your devices. Is that something that could be important in the future, do you think? Like, how long until we could see a mainstream sect of our culture that embraces an idea like that?
Yeah, I think it's going to happen when people are when they're mugged by reality. The biggest obstacle is overcoming the myth that you can't do it. And I think the second one is the obstacle is the idea people have that nobody else is doing it. And a lot of people are, more people than you realize.
Do you carry a smartphone with you?
I don't. I just have an ordinary phone. I don't know. I don't even text with it. I barely, you know, it just serves as a phone for me.
That's amazing, because I still get panicked when I accidentally forget mine at home or something like that. It's like my world has come crashing down, even though I can access everything anywhere I want on the internet. I still feel that sort of uncomfortableness from not having it with me.
Right. I mean, technology should serve us, and we shouldn't serve technology. When things get out of hand, when life becomes just an opportunity for a Facebook post or a selfie, then we really got problems. You know, we need to use the technology, but use it wisely.
It's like all those museums banning the selfie stick, so that way you'll actually stop and look at the art that you're witnessing.
Right. I mean, we're not meant to mediate things through our machines. We've got eyes. We've got our whole way of being is made for that. We get much more out of it when we don't see it through those things.
How does today's technology potentially compromise a child's imagination or the development that they have when they're young and growing up?
Well, I think it definitely does. Children need time to connect with the real world and to develop their skills, their social skills, their motor skills, so many of the things that will eventually help them adjust to the modern world. And what you're seeing today is a lot of children that can't fix things, that can't play with blocks, that can't, you know, even go out sledding. I mean, these are the kind of things that are they're losing, and much to their detriment. They need these occasions and social skills, you know, when they're just looking at their machines all the time. People, they need to, they're connected, but they're not really communicating.
Do you have any information to suggest what this might do with our health?
I don't actually. No, I haven't even thought about that. But I know the one thing, and I mentioned this in the book, technology, too much technology does speed up our lives, and it increases the stress and anxiety that we have. We become part of the machine, and you know, we have to keep up with it. So it does have mental and even physical health.
Yeah, I can only imagine when you say that kids don't know how to go sledding, or like I said before, ride a bike or something, how much I relied on that as a health aid also when I was a kid. I can't imagine not having that.
Right. I mean, I just wrote an article about that, and they talked about how many cities across the country are banning sledding because it's too dangerous and there's liabilities, and they're even one city even bulldozed down a hill just so children wouldn't play on it.
They could play it digitally on their tablet.
Exactly. Exactly.
How else could too much technology pose a liability to children and families besides just getting hurt, not knowing how to sled and getting hurt? Are there other ways that they could be harmed?
I think it is ironically, technology is there to connect us and to improve communications, but we're not seeing that. We're seeing connectivity, but not communication. So you go to an airport or a restaurant, everyone's isolated. They're connected to their phones and to their devices, but they're not engaging in that face-to-face relationship, which is much, much more important than just what they get on the phone. Much more is actually, I've heard or read a study saying this, much more is communicated by the tone of the voice, the intensity, all sorts of nuances that you don't find on the phone or the text message.
In the media, we deal a lot with people expressing themselves to us kind of facelessly. They're able to touch with us without having to actually reap the consequences of hurling, insulting things to one another. I think that's prevalent on the internet in general. Is that something that we're gonna lose the ability to handle conflict one-to-one because we are able to hide digitally?
Right. I mean, the lack of civility is noted all over the place. You know, it's not that people don't want to be civil. It's just they've see that they can be uncivil without facing the immediate consequence of a punch or something, you know, that tells them that they've done something wrong.
Your book is Return to Order. It's about finding or restoring, rather, fiscal responsibility for our nation and possibly even our culture and larger, maybe yep. beyond even the U.S.
Right. It is much more cultural than an economic book. I'm not an economist, but I deal with the cultural implications of what's happening in our economy and how we need a return to order, to return to the real world and not this fantasy world like of Steve Jobs and, you know, this what I called frenetic intemperance.
When you suggest real world, what are you aiming for? What's the goal here to get back to?
Well, I mean, you cannot legislate, stimulate, or regulate an economy or culture into order. It just doesn't work. What you need to do is go back to those natural regulating institutions inside society, especially those dealing with family, faith, and community, that what I called an organic society, where there are those natural links that allow us to resolve our problems, to bring us back to to the reality of our life in community and life in society.
It's interesting. We've gotten real far away from that. Is there anybody taking action within our government? Is there anyone that's, besides yourself, writing articles and books, that's really having a bigger, that has a big mouthpiece that is helping get your message across?
Well, I mean, there are definitely a lot of people out there that are mentioning this. They're showing the ramifications of this and working toward that. But, I mean, I think a lot of it's going to solidify when people are mugged by the reality, that more and more people are being mugged by reality, and that I hope to see that there will be reactions as time goes on.
To find out more about Mr. Horvat, please visit returntoorder.org. John, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Yeah, just to mention that on returntoorder.org, we just published the paperback edition after our hardback, and so we're offering a limited number of free paperbacks. If you go onto that site, you can go there and actually get the book.
And start making changes in your own life to help maybe influence the larger culture.
Absolutely. That's the whole idea.
John, thanks for joining us.
It's been great.
And thank you for joining us. Conversations is a public affairs program of this station.
Good morning and welcome to Conversations. I'm your host, Tony Russell, and I'm so pleased that you have joined me this morning. I want to talk about something that really, to be honest, has been driving me crazy lately, and that is the price of airline tickets. And not only that, the conditions that surround flying from time to time. My family lives on the East Coast, and of course, I'm here in the Great Northwest. So if I want to fly there, if I just want to go by myself, the cost is unbelievable. If I would love for my three kids and my wife to go with me and join me to get to see my lovely parents, then the price skyrockets. I mean, if you put on baggage fees and you put on the ticket fees and all the other stuff that goes into it, it is a major investment for me personally. Maybe it isn't for you, but then I get on the airplane and I'm not always crazy about the conditions. So I think, man, what am I really paying for? And after all, I thought the price of gasoline compared to a couple of years ago has gone down tremendously, yet the price of tickets to fly seem to be the same or maybe even higher. So I've heard about this young lady named Kendall Creighton. She's with FlyersRights.org, and I decided that maybe we would bring her on the show.
Maybe Kendall can answer some of these questions that we have. Why are the price of airline tickets so high, even though gas prices have gone down? Is there anything that we can do as consumers to get a little more space in that seat so the guy in front of me is not always, you know, backing up his tray into my abdomen? So let's see if flyersrights.org can help us. Good morning, Kendall. How are you?
Great. Great, Tony. Thanks. How are you doing?
I am wonderful. Thanks for joining us here on Conversations this morning. I actually came across your website online and saw you talking about something that has really kind of been driving me crazy, and so I'm hoping you'll have an answer for me. Well, my first question is, how is it that gas prices have gone down? I mean, considerably. But yet we're still paying as much or more for airline tickets, because I thought that the reason the prices of airline tickets went up was because of the fuel cost.
Exactly. And that is our number one issue right now. In fact, Flyers Rights is telling the airlines, stop fueling around. Because
I like that. Stop fueling around.
All the CEOs of all the airlines and said, this is what too suspicious. You're not lowering the fares. It looks like some kind of antitrust issue is going on here where you're monopolizing, you're controlling the market, and all you U.S. airlines are all keeping your airfares high, whereas overseas, they're lowering their prices and doing the right thing, but not here. So so anyways, we've sent out a press release, and we're saying there should be some legislative action. There should be some – Congress should be looking at this issue. It does look like – major ripping off of passengers currently going on right now.
Well, it's sad because, you know, I live here on the West Coast and I have a family on the East Coast, and, you know, I have a family of five. So, I mean, for me to be able to go visit is almost impossible. I mean, because it would literally cost me, what, probably $6,000 just, you know, just to fly.
I know. Yeah, you can't take a vacation.
Right.
Prices are so much higher than they used to be, and they're just going up and up, and there's no relief in sight. So this is where Flyers Rights is saying we need to like take a look at this. It looks like collusion with the airlines, keeping their fares high, and then not only are you squished when you are on the plane, it's like you're being ripped off left and right, and then the fees, and then, you know, you bring your extra luggage for the kids, and then that's going to cost $25, $50 each, and it's just incredible. It's too much money. We have a passenger bill of rights, actually, on the brink of being introduced in Congress, which says we need more regulation of these airlines, and they're taking advantage of passengers and they're...
What started FlyersRights.org? What started this desire to have an airline passenger's bill of rights?
Well, Flyers Rights was founded in 2006. Our founding member, Kate Hanai, was trapped on the tarmac for over 9 hours. So she had a bunch of passengers on the plane get together and give her email and, you know, let's get something done here. This should be illegal, and here we're trapped in these terrible conditions. And so that was our launching point, I guess. We had this three-hour rule passed by the Department of Transportation that said, no, airlines can't keep you on board that long, longer than that. So, and then now we have another Bill of Rights we want to have passed, which talks about seat space, number one. You have no legroom anymore in coach, and there's no minimum standards. So airlines keep squeezing and squeezing and squeezing in these new seats. And then delays and cancellations. We're trying to mimic more the European Union's rules, which are so much better than here in the U.S., where the airline has to take care of you. They're required to take care of the customer if you're delayed or if your plane isn't ready and you're stuck in the airport for a long time. You know, they have to provide you with accommodations and transportation to the hotel, and if you're stuck for a long time, and feed you and everything. And here you're kind of just left on your own.
Right.
So, and then lost and damaged luggage. Currently, if they lose your luggage, I mean, you already paid $25 to $50 to just check it, and then they lost it, or it's super delayed, like we've had here in Denver, where people are waiting just days to get their luggage back. So you should have instant refund of that price you paid to check it.
Wow. Yeah, you know, I never even thought of that. So let's say you pay $1,000 round-trip ticket. You're paying another $50 to check your luggage, and then they lose your luggage, and then they don't have to reimburse you for the luggage fee.
No, there's no customer service, and it's, you know,
Oh, going on, calling customer service can be a nightmare as well, right?
Yeah, I know. It's a waste of time. So just go straight to the Department of Transportation, DOT's website, and then they'll get right on top of the airline. They're usually much better than just going directly to the airline. Go to them and then work around. You'll get your money back that way.
Now, the airline passenger's bill of rights that you guys have been proposing since 1999 would allow passengers the option of getting off delayed planes after 3 hours on the ground, and requires airlines to provide adequate food, water, temperature control, ventilation, and, of course, working toilets to accommodate a three-hour delay. That doesn't seem like you're asking for much when you're just saying, hey, you know, if it's a three-hour delay, we'd like, you know, to be accommodated for that. Now, but that bill has not passed?
No, it has. Yeah, we did get the three-hour delay bill passed in 2009. That's good. We've had that done.
Okay.
And now we have a second. We're calling it the Passenger Bill of Rights 2.0, where we're just doing more seat space, fees, like junk fees. And on our website, we have our whole Passenger Bill of Rights, which we would like to, you know, propose in Congress, listed on there. We have 32 different points we want to address. And, you know, flying is just so difficult now, and we're just trying to make it civilized and just humane. I mean, we're not asking for much.
Right. And, you know, you guys, I guess, have, what, over 40,000 members now with FlyersRights.org?
Yes, over 50,000 members of FlyersRights.org, and they receive a newsletter, a weekly newsletter, and people can go to our website and sign up if they want to get involved or just hear about things we're doing and help out as much as they can. It'd be great. Volunteer-wise, it'd be great.
And tell me now, what about the Boxer Snow Airline Passengers Bill of Rights?
Yeah, that goes back to our original, our claim to fame, which was you can't be trapped in these inhumane conditions on the airline like you used to be. And so we had that all passed. It was good to go. It was, you know, got the stamp of approval. So that's in a rule now. Airlines they'll be fined $27,500 per passenger by the DOT if they pull that stunt. And they have been fined a few times.
And you kind of alluded to this earlier. You were talking about there just needs to be more done to restore the rights of passengers who are being squeezed physically and financially. So you really believe that you guys can get something done so that we're not all squeezed into the airplane?
Well, we're saying seat width should be 17 inches. I mean, that's tight enough, and airlines are squeezing it down even tighter. And then your leg room should be at least 30 inches, 31 inches, not 28, 27.
So, but if they offer larger seats, that means there's going to be fewer people in the airplane, then won't that mean they would have to actually increase the price?
They've been making high profits for the last 6 years, record profits, and I can... If those profits were actually going to the employees and actually being reinvested in things, but it's mostly going to the airline CEO, going to shareholders.
Right.
We're not asking for much. We're just asking for a little bit more space. I mean, it's not like they're not, you know, we're not asking for, you know, these big lounge chairs in there for sure. We're just asking for a teeny bit of standard space room. So, you know, we're not going to have this, you know, fighting on the plane when the seat ahead of you reclines and all that, and it's just too tight.
It is, you know, so basically you're just asking the airlines to make it more comfortable both financially and physically.
Exactly.
And so what is a way that our listeners can help you and get involved?
Well, the best way would just be going to our website, FlyersRights.org, and signing our petition would be great for the new Passenger Bill of Rights 2.0. They can sign up to receive our newsletter. If they need help at the airport, they should put our hotline phone number in their phone before they go in case they need a call. We have a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week manned hotline, which is 1-877-FLYERS-6. So that's 1-877-359-3776. And call us if there's any, you know, big snag or any problem you're encountering at the airport, and we can certainly help you out.
I like how you use the word fair. It seems like we're moving quickly toward the only people being able to fly is, you know, the top 2%, as they say. You know, you almost have to be wealthy or flying on your company's dime to be able to fly.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right, and to get back to actually the original question. So when you ask the airlines, hey, why are you still charging these outlandish fees to fly, despite the fact that fuel costs are much lower? They really didn't have an answer for you. It doesn't sound like.
Oh, because they can. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They said they're. What it was one of the quotes again. No, we're not going to pass up on this opportunity. They because that would be leaving money on the table. Was one good quote.
Wow. At least they're honest about it. My goodness. Well, yeah, we'd like to lower, but why would we do that when we can make a huge profit? That's what it sounds like.
And nobody calls them out on it. You know, everyone in Congress, well, that sounds fine to us, and they could care less.
Because they're, you know, people in Congress are probably flying on your and my dime, right? I mean, they probably don't pay for their airline tickets. Maybe they do, but I doubt it. I want to again thank you, Kendall, for being with us today on Conversations. Remember, Conversations is a public affairs program of this station.